Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Neurology Exam Prep Podcast. My name is Vanessa. I'm one of the neurology PGY2 residents here at Yale. And today I'll be talking about functional neurological disorders here with our well-known Dr. Mueller.
Vanessa, it's a delight. And I want to give you credit for coming up with the idea of focusing on this, right? I think it's something that doesn't necessarily come up a lot on certification exams, although more and more, there's more and more known about functional neurological disease and functional neurological disorders. And I think there's an increasing acknowledgement that neurologists play an important role in the care of people with functional neurological disease, even beyond the diagnosis. And our understanding of the mechanisms of these diseases, how they present, and their treatments, at least the initial steps toward treatment, is really important. So I thought it was a terrific idea when you proposed this, and I think our listeners will enjoy it too.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be a very productive discussion. And I had this idea because we encounter this diagnosis or we talk about it in clinical practice so often. So I figured it would be a very interesting thing to bring up to our listeners. We'll talk a little bit about the epidemiology, risk factors, which is a big thing. Then we'll talk about the diagnostic criteria, which is something that usually people have a lot of doubt about. And then we can touch a little bit on prognosis and on specific functional neurologic disorders. Dr. Mueller is an epileptologist, so we'll talk a lot about PNEA and also functional movement disorders. So without further ado, we can go ahead and start a little bit. So I just wanted to mention that functional neurologic disorder is also known as conversion disorder by the DSM-5 and dissociative neurological symptom disorder on the ICD-11. Dr. Mueller, you can talk a little bit about the pathophysiologic processes and kind of start talking about the epidemiology for us.
Yeah, so I think the term dissociative neurological symptom disorder has some utility in understanding what's been explained to me about the pathophysiology of this disorder. Conversion disorder is probably a little more simplistic. It's an older fashioned term. The idea that our internal anxieties or emotional distress is being converted into physical symptoms, I think it's much more complex than that. And functional neurological disease is maybe a broader spectrum because it suggests that these are disorders that affect our ability to function in the world, but that we don't totally understand always exactly what's happening. You know, one of the things that we often explain to patients, so that I'll explain to patients with psychogenic non-epileptic attacks, for example, is a little bit about dissociation. You know, that it is a normal human response to emotional distress, especially severe emotional distress, to disconnect or dissociate as a protective mechanism. And for a variety of reasons, that type of dissociation can be augmented. There can be genetic components, early life experiences, major trauma, but not always, and other factors that make it more likely for some people to develop dissociative symptoms very quickly. This, importantly, is a subconscious phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It is not under people's voluntary control, and it is real. You know, we often emphasize the fact that we don't distinguish between functional illness and illness that is real or illness that is biological or illness that is organic. I mean, this is the brain as well. It's a real phenomenon. And in fact, we've made progress in the care and treatment of people with functional neurological diseases by framing it in an affirmative way. There are diagnostic criteria, there are clinical features, there's a pathophysiology that we're learning more and more about. There are treatments that are all specific to this category of diseases. And the general category of diseases includes symptoms and signs genuinely experienced. You know, there are things that the person really experiences. They can cause alterations in the way you interact with the world, abnormal movements, abnormal sensation, abnormal experiences, things that look like seizures, and that this impairs your overall function. You know, I am optimistic that we will continue to understand more and more about exactly what goes into this. Maybe we'll hone our knowledge about the dissociative process, about the ways in which certain people are more or less susceptible to developing these disorders. And I think that will allow us to improve our treatments.
Yeah, I think that one thing that it's usually very informative and very helpful for the patients when we are discussing this diagnosis is that the hardware versus software analogy, the patients usually find it very concrete. So telling them that there's not a hardware, there's not a structural issue with the brain or with the nervous system, but the way that it's functioning, the software, that's where the functional neurologic disorder issue lives in. And they usually, again, they're very appreciative of this type of analogy.
Yeah, I think that analogies can help. I think that ongoing dialogue with a patient, I mean, if you and I, Vanessa, are having a hard time understanding the pathophysiology of this disorder and its origin and how it's diagnosed and treated, then it's hardly surprising that patients might have a hard time understanding that too. And it's often a journey. It's often a number of conversations and questions. And we're fortunate to live in a world now where there's lots of information on the internet, including extremely reliable information on the internet. For example, I often point patients to the sections on psychogenic non-epileptic attacks in epilepsy.com. I find that an amazingly useful resource. It's written clearly, concisely, and in a way that is non-judgmental.
So talking a little bit about the epidemiology, I think that will be very clear of how important this conversation today is, how prevalent the FND is worldwide and here in America. So functional neurologic disorder has been reported across the entire age spectrum from 4 to 94 years old. And there's a striking female predominance, although there are some proposed reasons for this predominance. We'll talk more about that when we talk about risk factors. And FND is one of the most common reasons for outpatient neurological consultations, comprising 1 in 6 referrals approximately. The prevalence here in America is thought to be amongst 250,000 to 300,000 people only here in the USA. So that's incredibly prevalent, and that's why we encounter so much during our clinical practice.
Yeah, I think any one of our listeners who's in training in neurology has encountered patients with functional neurological disorders. Vanessa, tell us a little bit about the risk factors. So we talked a little bit about pathophysiology, and we alluded to some of this, but I'd love to hear more about that.
The condition of FND is actually thought to be multifactorial, as it's a very complex and heterogeneous condition. But it's well known that exposure to psychological stressors and history of childhood adversity, particularly neglect, they are often encountered in patients with functional neurological disorders. But such events, they are not reported in over 50% of people in most studies. So it's a little unclear as well, even when they are present, if they play a role that is relevant on the disease course and the disease cause.
I actually think this is a really important point, Vanessa. You know, in my training, I think there was a much stronger emphasis on a history of early life trauma and the connection to certain types of functional neurological disease. But I think that, as you said, there's some more research sort of drawing questions about that and the direct relationship. Again, this goes back to the question about conversion, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that considering these disorders on their merits, especially as neurologists, we're not psychiatrists or psychotherapists, but neurologists, and not overemphasizing any history of trauma is often more appropriate and often more effective in our treatment of patients. I think sometimes drawing that straight line can minimize the process, can make connections that don't actually exist as strongly as we thought. And the fact is that people with a history of trauma have other neurological diseases that are totally unrelated, like strokes or seizures or multiple sclerosis. And similarly, people with no obvious history of trauma and no reported history of trauma, as you said, maybe up to half, can develop functional neurological disorders. So this connection is not as strong as previously thought. And I think one of the things we've learned is just to consider these disorders on their merits and avoid things that would bias or cloud the picture.
Great. And I think other important point to note is that other structural illnesses and injuries may predispose or even precipitate FND, such as epilepsy occurring or predating PNEA or migraines preceding functional limb weakness. So even structural organic conditions, other neurologic conditions can coexist with functional neurological disorders.
Yeah, we certainly see this all the time. You know, there's the question of one's experience of an illness and its manifestations. Sometimes it's very easy to make the connection between a structural or electrophysiologic change and the manifestations, and sometimes it's harder. And then we wonder if there is an underlying structural or neurophysiologic disease and then some psychogenic or functional augmentation of that experience. These can definitely coexist. And I've learned to be very humble in understanding functional neurological disease. We talked a little bit about our physiology and the risk factors. Why don't you walk us through some of the ways that we identify functional neurological disease, some of the ways that they present, and then we can get into some specific disorders.
So it's important to note that the diagnosis of FND is moving away from a diagnosis of exclusion. This is not a diagnosis of exclusion, but instead it should be made, the diagnosis of FND should be made by identifying the positive typical findings that establish the diagnosis. And some of the more well-recognized and typical findings are such as tubular visual field defects, distractibility, positive entrainment test. And for those who don't know what is an entrainment test, it's the change or elimination of the tremor as patients perform a voluntary movement by the unaffected limb. So this is especially for patients with functional tremors. Also, giveaway weakness. This is one thing that we see a lot. Those signs on physical examination, they demonstrate that the symptoms are inconsistent across different parts of the examination. And this is referred as internal inconsistency. This is a positive and very important point on the diagnosis of functional neurological disorders. And also the incompatibility between the patient's symptoms and recognized disease. There's not a certain anatomy or physiology that is compatible with known diseases. And I think that's the point that can cause a little bit of confusion.
Yeah. A note of humility here, Vanessa, you said incongruity with known diseases, but of course there may be unknown diseases, right? And I think often the best we can do, depending on the circumstances, unless we have a gold standard test, such as in psychogenic non-epileptic attacks with video EEG, it's say, likely functional, or there's a functional component, or until new information arises that we treat it as a functional disease. Again, positive framework. And our listeners, I really, if they want to take something away, is that this is not a diagnosis of exclusion, as you said. This is something we rule in, and there are certain features. And those certain features include that internal inconsistency, that incompatibility between the symptoms and what we understand about the physiology of disease. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that are going to really help. And, you know, it's really important to emphasize, you mentioned entrainment or the Hoover sign or some of the other clues that we use. I am very hesitant about using any single sign or symptom as the indicator of functional neurological disease. And we'll get into that with psychogenic non-epileptic attacks, which is what I have the most comfort with diagnosing. But any one sign could be seen in any disorder and does not necessarily rule in or rule out a functional neurological disorder. And I think we rely on these types of single signs to our peril. Mm-hmm. I have seen a positive Hoover sign in people with a myelopathy with spinal cord disease. You know, there are lots of reasons why that might exist. Things need to be considered holistically in the entire exam, in the history, in our understanding of disease. And I actually think that the diagnosis of functional neurological disease is one of the highest level activities we do as a neurologist. It's actually one of the most difficult things we do and the thing that requires the greatest confidence in our diagnostic skills. I think this is really important to get right.
Right. One point that is interesting to say is that those diagnostic guidelines, the DSM-5 and the ICD-11, they both say that FND is not a diagnosis of exclusion, which speaks on about what we are talking about. The previous versions of those guidelines, both the DSM-4 and the ICD-10, they both stipulated that FND had to be associated or caused by psychological factors. So a lot of patients, they didn't really fulfill all the criteria. So in the updated versions of both of those, we can do the diagnosis without identifying an underlying psychological factor, which goes back to what we discussed.
Yeah, I just think this is so important. I think that this is one of the areas in neurology that has changed so much, and I suppose psychiatry too. Another point that you have in your notes here, Vanessa, which I think is really important, is there is no part of this that suggests that any of the symptoms or signs are intentional, that a patient has any intention of presenting in this way. And we use terms like factitious disorder and malingering. I think both of these types of disorders, which are associated with intentional dysfunction for some sort of gain, are exceedingly rare. I mean, exceedingly rare. I am not confident that I have really ever seen that. I'm not confident that I've ever seen either of those types of intentional disorders. I really believe that. And whereas I've seen thousands or tens of thousands of patients with various types of functional neurological disease, or what I believe to be the case. And we have to have this in our heads and our hearts when we're encountering patients with functional neurological disease in order to be intellectually honest and in order to provide the best care. And when we communicate this diagnosis to patients, one of the things we say very clearly is this is not intentional. It's not involving feigning symptoms. It is not involving a choice to do this. And in fact, people can have injuries, disability. People with psychogenic non-epileptic attacks have worse outcomes functionally and socioeconomically than people with epilepsy, for that matter. And we might talk about that a little bit more. This is not a choice that anybody would make voluntarily.
Right. Other point that it's also related is that most clinicians have a little bit of hesitancy about diagnosing FND with fear of missing an organic cause of the patient's presentation. But there is extensive research already on this topic, and most of them show that the risk of diagnosing FND in a patient who actually had an organic condition is very, very low, approximately 0.4% in most studies. But the converse situation of incorrectly diagnosing other neurologic disorders in patients who are found to have FND, it's much higher, about 10%, 6 to 10% in some studies.
Yeah, I think this is why I say this really requires some of the highest level of skill as a neurologist. And, you know, as we do in the diagnosis of any disorder, we take all the symptoms and signs and the results of the diagnostic tests on balance. We consider it carefully based on our knowledge of disease, and we arrive at a most probable diagnosis, some reasonable alternatives, and we keep an open mind in case things change, right? And I think we follow this process regardless of the disease process, and that includes with functional neurological disease. It is really important for our listeners to understand one of the reasons we want to make sure that we move forward with a positive diagnosis of functional neurological diseases so that we can move forward with treatment. And we don't necessarily want to delay the most effective treatment options for a patient with FMD just because we're waiting for this or that test, which we think is almost certainly not to be informative in these patients. And so it's a balance. I think it's one of the hardest things we do. It's one of the things I actually find very rewarding because it's combines both the art and science of medicine. And I'm not the world's expert at functional neurological disease, but as an epileptologist, you know, somewhere between 20 and 30% of the new patients I see will not have epilepsy. They'll have psychogenic non-epileptic attacks.
And I think this hesitancy in making the diagnosis and moving towards the treatment, the specific treatment for PNEA, also has a lot of relation of why the prognosis is so poor. We see that in some studies, about 40% of patients with FND they are unchanged or even worse after a follow-up of about 7 years in one study that showed. And only about 20% achieve remission, which is very, you know, it speaks a lot about how long the diagnosis and the correct treatment take to be started.
And I think you'll talk about this a little bit, but people with one type of functional neurological disease often have others, you know, and you can have one manifestation and then over time it might change to another. Again, maybe an argument for longitudinal neurological care for patients with these types of disorders. I think we play an important role that we're recognizing even more and more in the ongoing care, counseling, and support of people with functional diseases. And I know a little bit about this because I have patients with psychogenic non-epileptic attacks. I have colleagues who focus a lot of their outpatient practice on the treatment of psychogenic non-epileptic attacks, but all of us as epileptologists are involved in the diagnosis and counseling of patients with this disorder. So tell us a little bit what you learned about PNEA, other than it has many, many different names.
Yeah, there are multiple names, proposed names currently. Psychogenic non-epileptic attacks is the most widely accepted one. And there is no single symptom that is pathognomonic or PNEA, but there are some signs with high sensitivity or specificity, including long duration of events, fluctuating asynchronous limb, the limb is fluctuating side to side, or side-to-side head movements, pelvic thrusting, ictal eye closure, ictal crying, although the ictal cry can be a sign of actual seizures, post-ictal memory recall as well, and peri-ictal responsiveness. Those are some features that can indicate to PNEA.
And the important point, Vanessa, and I've learned this as an epileptologist, every single one of those symptoms listed can be related to epileptic seizures, can be seen in patients with epileptic seizures. And again, going back to our clue, no single symptom is going to help. I think these things, I would add a few more, you know, a stopping and starting cadence. So for example, episodes that suddenly start and then suddenly stop and then suddenly restart and suddenly stop. That's a little difficult to explain on the basis of an electrophysiologic phenomenon. A lack of response to anti-seizure medication, right? So you have a strong suspicion that somebody has seizures, you start medication and they continue having episodes despite that, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, those things can be other clues, but any of these really only should point you toward referring somebody for video EEG monitoring. And the gold standard for the diagnosis of psychogenic non-epileptic attacks, or any of its other names, is going to be video EEG monitoring. And importantly, video EEG monitoring that's interpreted by somebody with a lot of experience in interpreting seizures. Because we do have this phenomenon, the older term we used to use for functional seizures or non-epileptic attacks was pseudo-seizures. We don't use that anymore. I think it's a little demeaning to patients, and so we tend to avoid it. But there is a term that we sometimes, with a little joking, use for people who are misdiagnosed with non-epileptic attacks and actually have frontal lobe seizures, for example, and we call those pseudo seizures. You know, so a classic example would people with nocturnal hypermotor frontal seizures. They look really bizarre. They scream or swear or have really strange movements. Sometimes are difficult to respond to medications, and they do video EEG monitoring. Scalp EEG is negative, but it can be. You know, these are sometimes scalp negative seizures, epileptic seizures. And so the diagnosis is missed. This is one area to have an alert on. So the gold standard for psychogenic non-epileptic attacks would be video EEG in a place where you have people with lots of experience who take a lot of care at making this diagnosis, who understand some of the mimics, some of those seizures that present with bizarre features, some of those seizures that present with out scalp ictal discharges. and some common areas where you might not see scalp discharges. We've talked about this in other podcasts, and certainly in our epilepsy and EEG teaching would include deep structures. So the cingulate, the insular cortex, the orbitofrontal cortex, even mesial temporal cortex, or in an area of the brain with that where there's only a small area involved. You know, so somebody has an aura, you know, less than 10 centimeters squared is involved in the process, and you don't see an ictal correlate. So it's not just video EEG that's read by AI, or at least not yet. It's interpreted by somebody who's taken a history from the patient, who's looked carefully at the videos, and who makes a careful diagnosis.
Great, important considerations there. And what would you say about, we see that quite frequently in practice, people in the emergency department presenting with seizures, and they have prolactin and lactate measured. What would you say about those potential biomarkers?
Yeah, very importantly about prolactin is this could be an exam question, you know, on the right or on a certification exam about the significance of prolactin. So prolactin could be useful if the level within 20 minutes, so drawn within 20 minutes of the attack, is two or more times the baseline prolactin level. But Vanessa, you're a resident, you spend lots of time in the emergency department. How feasible is that, you know, to draw the level 20 minutes from the end of the attack, and then it rapidly declines after that? And then also to confirm that they don't have baseline elevated prolactin. And there are lots of reasons why might somebody have elevated baseline prolactin, including medications and pituitary issues, other hormonal issues, you name it. And so it has a very narrow range of utility. Even beyond that, it really only helps you distinguish, say, an epileptic seizure from a non-epileptic attack that looks like an epileptic seizure, because prolactin levels can also be elevated in syncope, which is our other big differential diagnosis for something that makes somebody fall down and shake, for example. So we don't tend to get very excited about it, because it's really tough to get that perfect circumstances where you have a baseline level or you're able to get it the next day, where the level was clearly drawn within a very short period of time, you know, 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes as a stretch, and where we had a clear, you know, bystander who was able to say when the episode ended and all that kind of stuff. Lactate certainly can peak after a convulsive episode, but you can also get elevated lactate if somebody has a really bad psychogenic attack. If they're really shaking and breaking down some muscle, and then you might see an elevated lactate in that process. So it doesn't have perfect performance characteristics. And again, all of these are just going to give you clues that might guide you towards wanting to push more towards video EEG monitoring. And again, I'll say it again, the gold standard would be capturing one of these events, seeing it and interpreting that in the appropriate clinical context, looking at the EEG. You know, that's the way we do it.
Awesome. Great, Dr. Muller. Would you also talk a little bit about functional movement disorders? We have some very interesting topics among this issue.
I have to admit, functional movement disorders can be really tough because, again, this is a tremendous art. And the movement disorder specialists and the neurologists who make the diagnosis of functional movement disorders don't even have the test that I have as an epileptologist of video EEG monitoring. Really, this is driven by their understanding, their deep and nuanced understanding of the phenomenology of movement disorders. And Vanessa, I don't have to tell you about the complexity of the visual diagnosis of movement disorders. There's many, many types of movement disorders, hyperkinetic, hypokinetic, you name it, right? And even within those many categories. Mm-hmm. But as you said earlier, the gold standard here would be demonstrating abnormal movements that cannot be explained by known phenomenology or known pathophysiology. And a positive diagnosis here is things that are inconsistent with known phenomena, but may have a functional dissociative component to them. But this is nuanced. And sometimes I still think there's ongoing inconsistencies here. These are very common. And there have been newspaper articles about functional tic-like behavior, for example, in adolescents, this TikTok Tourette's, where there was a very high degree of social media consumption during the peak of the pandemic in teenagers. And there was this functional tic-like behavior, FTLB, which didn't have the typical features of tics and may have been sort of an internalization of the tick behavior that people were seeing on social media. And people who know more than me looked at a lot of these videos and said that these aren't even ticks, right? They're not consistent. They don't have all the features of tics or other movement disorders, and they're likely functional in nature. It's really an interesting phenomenon, but I got to say, in these cases, if I have a colleague who's really knowledgeable about movement disorders, who's seen a lot, who knows really about all the phenomenology, I'm going to be asking them. As a general neurologist and an epileptologist, I don't have a high degree of comfort in making a diagnosis of functional movement disorders.
Yeah, it's a very complex phenomenon for sure. But this TikTok Tourette's, I found very interesting, and very interesting to see how this can be, people can be influenced and have developed one of those symptoms. We already touched a little bit on differential diagnosis when we spoke about FND, about PNEA, sorry. But would you tell us a little bit more about this, Dr. Mueller?
You know, and this comes back to your comments earlier about whether the symptoms are explained by a currently known neurological disease, and how we always have to keep an open mind and watch people carefully and make a considered diagnosis and keep seeing them and make sure that we've got this right. Sometimes it's very clear, and other times we're not sure. And the annals of medicine are absolutely bursting with stories of people who were misdiagnosed with functional neurological disease, especially things like autoimmune encephalitides, unusual movement disorders, unusual seizure disorders, you know, progressive disorders that just haven't quite presented themselves yet with the clear features that are going to clinch the diagnosis. And I think we just need to keep an open mind. I will admit absolutely honestly and fairly that I have encountered patients, met them for the first time, heard about really unusual episodes that I couldn't explain, that didn't fit with anything I'd quite heard before. And I wondered, maybe these are functional. Maybe these are psychogenic non-epileptic attacks. I always tell the patients, we need to see these. We need to bring you in. We need to try to capture one of your typical events, not just any event, but one of your typical events. And I've had this experience, every one of my colleagues has. We do it and it's a seizure. Or we do it and it's clearly a movement disorder or something else. And you know, I guess my pride is a little hurt that I didn't nail the diagnosis the first time. But the more you have this type of experience, the more you keep open the possibility that it could be something else. And you keep in your mind sort of the broad differential diagnosis for how it presents. And I will put out a warning. I think that the misdiagnosis of functional neurological disease is likely higher in people who have had more challenges with the medical system, people in lower socioeconomic status, people who have baseline significant psychiatric issues. They can still have a brain tumor, or they can still have epilepsy, or they can still have a myelopathy. You know, there's no reason you couldn't have both of those disorders, but often the diagnosis is delayed or treated as probably functional initially. And people with substance use disorders, we see this, you know, so we just have to keep a very open mind, and we always have to follow the same script and always use our best practices when making these diagnoses. And I think if we do that, I think we'll do well for our patients. That doesn't mean that we have to do every test and make a diagnosis of exclusion for everybody with functional neurological disease, but we have to do sufficient testing to feel confident that on balance, this is very likely functional. And even in those cases, we keep an open mind and say, if it changes, let's reconsider and let's look at those symptoms further and reevaluate. And I think if we do that, we'll do right by our patients and we won't be led wrong.
So very important and practical considerations. Why don't we touch a little on the treatment? How do we treat our patients who come in with probable functional neurological disorders?
This depends to some extent on the type of functional neurological disease. It depends to some extent on the severity and the impairment that the patient has. It depends on some extent to how long the disorder has been going on. For example, sometimes somebody with an acute functional neurological disease or with psychogenic attacks, for example, which just started and have not been going on for very long, in those cases, sometimes a clear diagnosis with thoughtful communication and a good patient understanding of the process and some reassurance may be sufficient. That might be enough. And it might not recur. That's often not the case And often there is something that needs to be, some further treatment that needs to happen. And we work very carefully with our mental health colleagues to do that. And this is a team sport. So for example, for psychogenic non-epileptic attacks, there's a lot of good evidence to suggest that cognitive behavioral therapy and certain approaches to cognitive behavioral therapy can be helpful. And I think our role in that is usually explaining how that might work, explaining how it might help, and directing people to the appropriate therapists who have some knowledge about these types of disorders. If there's comorbid underlying psychiatric disease that needs to be addressed separately, medications may be helpful in those circumstances. For example, treating comorbid mood disorders may be helpful. Treating comorbid substance use disorders may be helpful. And it's a very holistic approach. For people with functional weakness, there is some evidence that a rehabilitative approach may be helpful even if the patient doesn't have a full understanding of the nature of the disorder, that if somebody has functional leg weakness or functional gait dysfunction or something like that, that sometimes simply focusing on the process of mobilization, on the process of moving, on the process of strengthening, those things can be sufficient to generate positive outcomes, even in the absence of the other things I mentioned, therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy or treating other disorders. So it's with functional neurological disease, these are very tricky to treat. The longer they go on and the longer the delay to diagnosis, we know they're even harder to treat and they have a worse outcome. So early diagnosis, clear and thoughtful communication of the diagnosis, and very careful attention to follow up with both us to reassure and reinforce the diagnosis and with mental health providers to do therapy or prescribe medications as needed are all going to be critically important aspects of treatment.
And again, I think that it also speaks a lot about the prognosis. I feel that we are doing, not everyone is doing a good job in identifying and treating our patients with functional neurological disorder. And that's why most studies show that the prognosis is usually poor, with only about 20% of patients achieving remission.
It's a great opportunity to do even better for these patients. Sometimes we are the most significant healthcare provider as neurologists that they will see. We're certainly the person with the greatest authority. I, like many people who have been engaged in learning about neurology for a long time, become increasingly interested in this category of disorders. I still don't totally understand it, Vanessa. I really don't. But I understand it better than I did, and I understand my role in it a little better than I did in the past.
There's still a lot to be done. I'm sure about that. Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Mueller, to talk with me today. I hope this was helpful for everyone who's listening to our podcast. And yeah, thank you for having us today.
Thanks, Vanessa. I think this was really great.